for
this
now.
This content kind of does that to you.
Okay, good morning, colleagues, members of the audience. It's Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. This is the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. We have an exciting day in front of us. We're going to start with a discussion of civic education and then dual credit. So today's going to be kind of a P20 kind of day for us all. I'm going to open the informational meeting first on educating civically engaged youth in Oregon. And just as a kind of, just to kick this off, you know, one of the things that inspired this panel was a heretical comment that Representative Gallegos made a couple of weeks ago that, well, maybe higher ed isn't just all about job creation and, you know, skill building and 40-40-20, that maybe there's something about it, too, that has to do with creating informed citizens, or maybe...
Did I say that?
You said something like that. Wow. That was speaking to me in one ear, and then in the other ear, there's Rep. Wisnant, who at least once a day is saying something about civic education and the importance of our doing a better job of that. And so when Rob came to me and said he had a bunch of very excited and exciting people to talk to us about this subject, I just couldn't say no. So here we are. Rob, why don't you kick us off?
That's great. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Wagner. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Portland Community College. And I'm going to keep my testimony very limited in favor of you hearing from an amazing group of the civic stakeholders who are assembled here. Now, outside my professional work, I'm a volunteer with the City Club and serve on the Civics Education and Advocacy and Awareness Committee. And folks here will be talking more about the study and the research in a moment. But the question is, why are we here in the Higher Education and Workforce Committee talking about civics education? And I can say that everyone assembled here is passionate about lighting a fire under a conversation that is near and dear to the hearts of many of you, and that is that citizenship and civics education at all levels, from pre-K through post-secondary and throughout our lives, should be brought into our curriculum, that it is taught, that it is promoted, that it is recognized, and that it is celebrated. We've met with Kate Brown and Deputy Superintendent Rob Saxton. We're reaching out to meet with the OEIB and other committees in this capital. However, citizenship is also integral to the word workforce in the title of this committee name. We simply can't thrive as a free and open democracy without taking a look beyond workers and what it means to be an engaged citizen. I couldn't say it better than what was written in House Joint Resolution 36 in 2011, authored by Representative Wisnant, when he said, "An informed and capable citizenry is vital to the preservation of a free and democratic government."
Whoa.
It's a conversation that we're having beyond the walls of this committee room.
This guy right here, right?
Everybody slips sometime.
I'll be a witness for that.
Beyond K-12, beyond post-secondary, and following the inspiring testimony today, we hope that this is a flame and that we'll be looking to you, our state legislators, to help us light in the communities, in your communities, throughout the state. With that, I'll turn it over to Akeem Ballard. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Rob. Welcome, Akeem.
Thank you. I'm actually going to turn it over to Jim Gorder first, okay, who has some opening comments, I think, will.
Great. Thank you. My name is Jim Gorder, and I chaired the Civic Education and Civic Engagement Research Committee for the City Club of Portland last year, and I'm currently on the Advocacy Committee. Research at the national level shows that young people are not civically literate and not civically active. Our research led us to the conclusion that Oregon's young adults are no different from their counterparts across the country, and that our educational system is not preparing large numbers of them for higher levels of civic engagement. We focused our efforts on the high schools of Portland Public Schools. However, we feel our conclusions and recommendations are applicable throughout the state at all grade levels, including university and college level. Democracy requires civic preparation. the knowledge, skills, and dispositions for civic civic participation. The knowledge of skills and disposition for civic engagement cannot be learned just by osmosis and observation. Direct instruction through the social studies curriculum is essential. And there are proven practices that can be used in the schools to promote civic engagement. Social studies is not a priority in the state of Oregon or in Portland schools. We heard repeatedly that what is tested is what gets taught, and that means reading, writing, and math. Time, resources, rewards, and punishments are all directed to the tested subjects. Civics education or civic preparation is not a priority in Oregon's public universities, colleges, and community colleges either. Civics or government courses are not required for graduation from these institutions. And the expectations for citizenship have been lost in the shuffle at the state level also. The mantra we repeatedly hear from Washington, D.C. to Salem to Portland is that of college and career. Good citizenship is never mentioned. Education for citizenship needs leadership and support. In the Portland Public Schools, there is no person at the district level who is responsible for coordinating and leading civics and social studies. At the State Department of Education, one person has 20% of her time assigned to social studies to cover the entire state. Looking at both the state and local levels, additional leadership and support are needed.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon.
Okay. Hello, Chair Dimbrough and members of the committee. My name is Akeem Ballard. I am a current Portland Public Schools teacher at Lane Middle School. I have the privilege of educating some of the stuff we're talking about and the honor. And I also am a member of the Civics Advocacy and Awareness Committee, as well as these two. Thank you for your time here today, and I'm glad that we've been able here to discuss some of the data, some of the reports that have been coming out, some of the work that you all and we all have been doing. And as an educator, I get the honor and privilege of sharing and seeing and supporting the stories behind the data. And those stories are kids, some of whom you'll hear from today, and their incredible journey through civics education, through their competitions, and through their teachers, and maybe even their stories as their parents have known them as well. And what I get to do every day is not only see the downfalls of not having some support behind civics education, advocacy, awareness, and social studies, but also see the powerful nature that can come out of the discussions and the research that students will do. As an educator, we get to support our students in trying to be action researchers, to not only see the world around them, not only to understand it, but to understand their agency in it, to be powerful change agents and community members, to make their community how they see fit, to fit the needs of who they are and who they could be, much as I assume that your jobs do every day. You get to support your constituents and support their story and their dreams. And as you've heard from the data, there's not much support behind it, not much fiscal support, not much employment support behind it, but that doesn't mean that we can't start to shift our students' paradigm of the capital and the people to a paradigm of reality. Right now, for many of them, it's that thing that we study in the textbook somewhere over there. But what happens when we bring them here, or we bring representatives and workers from the capital into the schools, making our schools into quasi-community spaces? What happens when our students are no longer researchers of the world around them and their communities, but they're action agents in it? And I think that's the honor that I've had in supporting my students doing that through deep and meaningful curricula that looks at civics, that looks at civic engagement, that looks at how to become an active citizen, not only through the word, but through the world around them, much in Paulo Freire's notion of reading the world around us so we can support the world that we want it to be. So I'm here today to testify to that, to support you all in the work that we can do by building bridges, by having students come to the Capitol, by having students learn about their society and their citizenry in a real and meaningful way so that they're not only voting on a ballot, but they're voting on a ballot that means something and that they know what it means. So thank you for your time today, and I hope that my testimony has supported and shown some insight into what we can do together to make sure that our citizenry is not only prepared but excited for tomorrow.
Thank you, Hakeem. Questions of this panel? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And let's have some students.
Hi, my name is Abigail Woods. I'm 12 years old, and I go to school at Da Vinci Arts, and I graduated from Opal Charter School, and I live in Portland, Oregon. I recently got to participate in a trip to Washington, D.C. to meet Oregon State Representative Suzanne Bonamici as part of the Take Our Daughters to Congress program. I knew going on this trip would provide me great opportunities to put my voice out into the world so that others can hear it. This is very important to me. One thing I took back with me is an understanding of how significant every single aspect of Congress is and how everyone plays a very essential role. It's much like a family. I think all students should have the opportunity to have similar experiences because this can open up very big doors for them. Visiting Washington, D.C. to see a congressional hearing and this experience today in the state legislature shows me the power of one person's voice. I also learned from a young age how to debate and share ideas in our community in a respectful, safe environment. Students who don't have these opportunities are definitely missing out. I learned that a kid's voice is valued when I had an editorial published in the Oregonian, and that was very powerful for me. And I want all kids to know that their voices can be heard, too. But some kids need help to be shown that this can be done. Everyone should be able to have the option to have a civic education and learn how they can have a voice and be able to use it in their community. If all students have some sort of civic education, they can learn how to find ways for their voices to be heard in our big world. I don't really want to be a politician, but that doesn't mean I can't help inspire other children who want to be in our government to get there. I want to solve problems in our community and make it better, and that is why I'm here today. We have to put civics programs back into all schools. We need to give everyone an equal chance to put their voice in the air because their ideas are fresh and they offer different perspectives, and that is what we need going into the next generation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Abigail. Mm-hmm.
Good morning, members of the House Committee on Higher Education. I'm Lauren Burns, an eighth grader from Wood Middle School in Wilsonville, Oregon, and I would like to thank you for your time this morning as you listen to a middle schooler's opinion about the importance of civic education. Last night, I returned from Washington, D.C., where my school's constitution team took second place at the inaugural We the People National Invitational. My learning to understand how our government system plays a part in my life as a student drove me to apply for a spot on the Constitution team. Learning to question how government might work in different situations, much like John Locke did, is the most important thing I've learned. I think civic education is important for three reasons. First, 50% of Americans under the age of 30 did not vote in the 2012 presidential election. People who know more about government will be encouraged to vote, empowering them to feel more in charge of their destiny. How will they understand how their government works without early civic education? Secondly, if people are civically educated, they will have opinions about the way they think government should run. With your opinions in mind, they can form coalitions with other like-minded people, accomplishing more than they would have done by themselves. How will they understand how their government works without early civic education? And finally, representatives are elected because those whom they govern trust them. To carry out the wishes of the people, they need to understand how American government works. How will they understand how their government works without early civic education? With the information I've gained from the civic program at my school, I intend to stay civically engaged. I plan to help start a constitution team at Wilsonville High School next year, and hope to pass on the importance and understanding of government to the students of my high school. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Lauren.
Hello, I'm Dylan Tingley, and I'm from Northeast Portland in Grant High School. Over the past year, I've had the opportunity to be involved with a program that has made me understand what it means to be a citizen of the United States. I joined the Grant High Constitution team because of the respect and emphasis the Grant community has for the program. The importance that community, and specifically my teacher, sees in the program has always made participation in the Constitution team a definitive goal for my senior year of high school. Reflecting on the experience, I can testify that it has been the most comprehensive and transformative educational experience of my life. The resounding significance of my experience lays in the impact it had on my perceived role as an individual in our society. Instead of being reminded of the happy stories of Washington crossing the Delaware, I now leave high school with a respect for due process that should reside in all Americans. I've learned what it means to be civically engaged, that the blessing of being born in this country necessitates active participation in the political process and an abiding respect for its founding principles. This lesson has led me to protest for increases in funding for education, to canvass voters in support of Planned Parenthood, and to rally in O'Brien Square to show solidarity with global workers' rights. In the following years, I will be attending college in New Orleans, where I intend to continue the work of urban renewal that is stressed through Tulane University. To close, I would like to say that if American democracy seeks to reach the full height that is demanded by its dignity and potential, then each student should be afforded the opportunity to learn what it means to be a passionately involved citizen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I do have one. So, you know, traditionally when we think of a civics class or a history class, we think of memorizing facts and, you know, Dylan, you mentioned Washington crossing the Delaware, and, you know, that we expect young people to learn these facts and remember these facts. But what you're talking about is something different, right? And
sure.
And could you say something about what's needed beyond just having a class, you know, in your school? I mean, that's important, but that's just one piece of it, isn't it? Any of you who would like to say something about that?
I think that, like how you said, memorizing facts, no one is going to remember them. And just farther than just a class, I think that they need to apply it outside. I know that we took the Constitution and applied it to different, different court cases and things in our life that really made sense, and that's how I feel like my learning has expanded, where I can go out of the class and see how, wow, that person really didn't get due process after they assigned time out or, you know, whatever, and I feel like I can see it involved in, like, different aspects of life that I've never seen it before. And so your question was, what's bigger than the class? And I think what's bigger than the class is just looking at the world around and seeing how just different parts of life are really connected with our government system. It's just interesting to look at.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What it means to be a citizen of the United States is to appreciate what you've been given and to understand that it comes with certain responsibilities. And so this class that I participated in and that you had the blessing mm-hmm. of participating in really goes beyond learning facts, although learning about due process and the curriculum is amazing. It also teaches you what it means to be a citizen and how you can give back to your community, which is the most important part.
Great, thank you. Rep Gorsuch.
So, very impressive. Sure. I teach at Portland State part-time and at Mount Hood Community College full-time, and I must say that you are right up there with many of my students. Very nicely done. The question I have for you then is, for each of you, if you care to answer, how did you first become interested in civics? And was it a teacher? Was it a the class, what was it that really kind of built that fire that you appear to all have for this particular topic?
At my elementary school, every single Wednesday we would take a notebook, and everyone would have an option to write a problem that they had in the notebook. And the teacher would come to the first problem, and we would have a leader of the, they would call it, I can't remember the name at the time, but it was really fun because we would arrange the desk in a circle so everyone had an equal chance and everyone could see everyone's face and be able to feel like everyone's equal when they're talking to each other. And we would just talk about the problem, and by the end of the meeting we would all feel like the problem was resolved and our brains were really refreshed because we felt like we could walk out and feel very, like, we felt very good about the problem because it was no longer stuffing up the air in our environment. And it was really good to start early, I think, because we started doing that in second grade, and they actually did that in really little classes, and the kids love to debate about it, and it's really, everyone's so passionate in there, and people would come in, and it was just, everyone loved to do it, and it was really engaging.
Thank you very much. Rep. Gallegos and Rep. Greenleaf.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for being here. You guys are great. I'm frustrated, though. Many of us are out doing town halls, trying to talk to folks in our districts and so on. And what I find frustrating is we get questions about the budget, about PERS, and about school funding and so on. But often the questions are like, the government's doing this or the government's not doing this. And I get frustrated because the people in the audience, we're all the government. I mean, everybody out here is the government. They elect people, they vote for people, they're involved. So I get frustrated with this business about, you know, us and them. And I don't know, do you have any ideas about overcoming that kind of divide?
I completely agree with your frustration. I think that civics education has the potential to transform citizens' views of their relationship with the government and understanding their role, the most important role in our society is that of the citizens. And I think that if we emphasize that more, we could see less cynicism of government and less of a combative relationship between constituents and representatives.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Rep. Greenleck.
Well, first I want to congratulate both of your teams on your performance. I've been following Grant's team since two of my granddaughters were a part of it.
And?
One of my sons is a coach. I have a sense, I was really intrigued with your statements about how young people aren't voting. And I worry about a sort of deeper underlying thing, and that's that people seem to have lost a sense of social responsibility. And we own these problems because they're our problems, as Representative Villegas says. And when a parent says to me in a town hall, well, what can I do to change this? And I say, well, you can help your children understand that they own our society. How can you guys, as peers to these people, try and, I sense you really understand the concept that there is social responsibility and we all own this problem. How can you help spread that sense? How can you help other students take some ownership in what's going on around them?
Well, I know that, for one, our middle school voted in the presidential election. Of course, it didn't count, but just as a middle school, to feel like we had just, you know, could vote and could cast a ballot for either President Obama or former Governor Mitt Romney, and, you know, just see that we're not as far away from the voting process as we really think we are. I totally agree with you about how people are not socially responsible. And, like, in my how I was testifying, how 50% of Americans from like 30 to, you know, 18 to 30 did not vote. I feel like what's really needed to get increase that voting is a lot more talk of it. And I know along my peers, we have just different opinions about politics and everything. Even people who weren't in the Constitution class, who some of them, you know, are total Democrats from just their moral beliefs. And I feel like talking about that socially as just their belief-wise and then contributing that or adding that definition of their morals to political government and how we can have a say in it is really important. And I know that I've, friends and I have talked about that and become really engaged in the process of becoming civically engaged throughout conversations like those. So morals, I think, is a really strong aspect of how you feel about government in the first place to open conversations.
Mr. Chairman, I follow briefly on them.
Very briefly, we're going to have to move on. Yeah.
I think the point you made is really important. I mean, I come out of a culture where the notion of repairing the earth is a basic part of our concept. I think there is a sort of underlying philosophical belief that we can do that. And you guys are obvious examples of what happens when it really works.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly, thank you all for your testimony. Thank you for being involved in learning about civics. I'd love to talk to you and debate about, I think the numbers of voting is important, but my position is it's more important to be informed. There's countries around the world that everyone has to vote, but they're told how to vote. Ms. Woods, I hope you'll reconsider your decision. You know, I don't plan to be a politician either, but always keep your options open.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, all three of you. And Lauren, good luck with your new team. We Grant coaches, watch out. Watch out for Wilsonville. I think you're going to have some competition. Thank you very much. Okay, next panel.
I think many of us did not plan on being here. I plan on being politicians.
It's a part-time job.
Okay, Hallie, did you want to start off? Or?
Sure. Hello, thank you for inviting me to speak. I'm Hallie Steiner. I'm a senior at Grant High School. I originally chose to participate on the Constitution team because my brother had been on it 2 years before. I closely watched him become immersed in an atmosphere of academia that was unseen in my public education career, and I wanted to discover it for myself. The experience has been life-altering. The team has welcomed me into a community of scholars, peers, neighbors, parents, all devoted to educating youth and winning, too. It is true that I now know numerous Supreme Court cases, constitutional clauses, historical events that shaped our country, and problems we as a democracy face, but I would never have appreciated the magnitude of these subjects if it weren't for the way they were taught. The most important thing I've learned from this experience is understanding how to learn. Extensive reading, analysis, civil discourse, and presentation are the key factors in education. Unfortunately, in a 40-person class, this kind of learning is a gift. What I've taken from the Constitution team is a realization that all students should have access to this kind of hands-on civics education. In Conteam, I was never tested on the facts of what I'd been researching and studying, never asked to fill in bubbles. Instead, I was depended on by teammates to articulate it, write about it, question it, and formulate my own opinions. The towering educators, our coaches, maintain a dialogue at all time, utilizing Socratic method lost in high school today. I think it's crucial that students learn about government in this way because it allows a free flow discussion and a place where ideas about the past and future can culminate in a way that benefits everyone. Our country needs this kind of civic education in order to create a society in which active citizens are capable of engaging in civil discourse to deal with pressing issues and work with one another despite our differences. What I've learned in Conteam has already guided how I'm approaching college. I plan to study international relations and political science. I wish to pursue a career in international human rights law and women's rights. But I will take my appreciation for civic engagement in community even further. I would be nowhere without the community behind the team who taught me the importance of good citizenship. Education should be personal, and every student deserves the support and encouragement I experienced. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, it's an honor to follow such inspiring testimony from these folks joining me here today. For the record, my name is Raylene McMillan, and I'm here actually wearing a few hats. I am a student at Portland Community College and a student senator for the Sylvania campus for Associated Students of PCC. I'm also a government relations intern under Rob Wagner over here, and I do also happen to intern at City Club as a communications and office assistant over there. So kind of a serendipitous link of all these folks here. I'm ecstatic to be here. I'm working right now towards a BA and then a master's degree in political science, and my aspirations are to teach political science. I surround myself with fellow civic participants these days, so it's tempting for me to forget that a large portion of the population feels entirely disengaged from the legislative process and from the republic within which it resides. Not enough of us are taught at a young age. For me, it was by my grandfather that government is really only an elusive experience institution if we allow it to be. I've wanted to teach high school social studies since I took high school social studies. My grandfather's dinnertime public issues soapboxes had instilled an early political intrigue in me. And in 1999, at McMinnville High School, an instructor by the name of Brian Thibault dissolved any doubt that this eventually would be my course of study. Brian's sharp and inspired presentation of civics curriculum had such a significant influence on me that finally entering college 11 years later, which is a whole other testimony perhaps for another day, I beelined for the political science department. Because of this high school instructor, I possessed an early sense that public policy was something that I could have an active relationship with. The value this held for me is truly immeasurable, and it is my hope that we can offer this foundation for engagement to as many young adults as possible within our public school curriculum. Though I could sit here all morning expanding on my firm belief in stronger civic education, I will yield some time here, respectfully close. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, thank you so much for your valuable time this morning.
Thank you very much, Raylene. Any questions? Raylene, at some point, you don't have to do it now, but I know you've been watching us for a few months now. I have some trepidation asking what you've been, what you've noticed about how we operate here in the legislature. You don't have to answer that now. We can do that offline. But Hallie, thank you very much. Your comments really are, about what constitutes true learning. I think really hit the mark. We had a hearing on Monday dealing with the subject of career technical education, very different in some ways, but also fundamentally the same. That is, one learns by doing, and that's really what a program such as yours was all about. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, finally, last panel.
Good morning. I'm Gail Thiemann, an associate professor at Portland State University, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I teach social studies methods to future social studies teachers, and as well as instructional planning and technology. And as past president of the National Council for Social Studies, I'm very aware of what's happening in social studies, both nationally and here in Oregon. Given the short amount of time, I may just quickly go through a very few of the slides. You have the PowerPoint handout so you can read it more at your leisure. But the purpose of this study was to find out what's happening in social studies after a decade of NCLB. And we sent this online survey to almost 8,000 teachers in Oregon and got about 800 back, and so we have a pretty good sample of what teachers feel. We also have a very representative sample in the survey. I'm going to focus very briefly on four questions. We asked, how much instructional time is devoted to social studies? How has mandated testing affected social studies? What are the major goals of the curriculum? And how often and what types of instructional activities are our students engaged? And what we found was not surprising, but always disappointing, that Oregon elementary teachers say they teach social studies less than 3 hours a week. That means about 100 hours a year. compared to 1,000 hours for all of the other core subjects, reading, writing, math, and some science. Middle school teachers have a little bit more time, but it's often taught in conjunction with language arts. And since language arts is the tested subject, that's what gets the priority, not social studies. I not only have this from the survey results, I have it from the hundreds of social studies student teachers that I've supervised in the Portland metropolitan area for the last 7 years. We're also looking at the impact of mandated testing, and over 60% of all the Oregon teachers at all grade levels are saying time for social studies decreased drastically when the mandated testing through NCLB began. And it's impacting Oregon teachers worse than the national average. And you know that the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, civic leaders and business leaders talk about the importance of some key skills in citizenship, that we want students to be informed, as Representative Wisnett talked about, understanding complex public issues, enabling our citizens to think critically and creatively, being able to communicate and work collaboratively. We know that some of these curriculum concepts are definitely taught in the public schools, and that's good. You see, at elementary school, civic responsibility and democratic values in the red are about a third of teachers teach this weekly. But then you see in middle school and high school, the emphasis is on history and current events, and not as much on civic responsibility. We looked at instructional strategies, and we see that teachers are helping our students learn how to communicate through orally, through discussions, and in writing, examining primary sources. What the slide doesn't show you is that very few teachers are engaging their students in role-playing, simulations, mock trials, competitions, which are ways to develop students' higher-order thinking and decision-making skills, as you've heard from the students here. And I'm going to skip past the questions, statements about technology, and talk about professional development. Professional development is key to maintaining an effective teaching force. 39% of the teachers in this survey, the social studies teachers, reported they hadn't attended any social studies professional development in the last year of the survey. About one-fifth said they'd attended three or more. So we have a case across the state of some areas in the urban and suburban areas, teachers have the opportunity to attend workshops, but not so much in rural areas. So we have teachers in Bend, the Oregon coast, eastern and southern Oregon, who make the trek to the Willamette Valley for professional development, but it's on weekends, and they are responsible for all of their own expenses to attend this. So it's not surprising that teachers report that the biggest barriers to participating in professional development they need to be effective social studies and civic education teachers is time, the cost, and nothing's offered in their content area, mostly because nothing's offered in their area for social studies. So what should schools be doing? We think we know that schools need to enable students to do social studies, like you've heard from the outstanding students today. And these activities require professional development for teachers and a commitment of district resources. Some districts include all these activities in their curriculum. Some of them put them in after-school activities, but many districts across the state have no civic engagement activities for students, like you heard here, even though every district has an athletic program. So we're asking legislative leaders to support civics, to insist that it's part of the Common Core, and provide resources to support instruction, field trips, and professional development. In closing, as a nation and a state, we have not prioritized the importance of civic education. STEM and literacy are in the spotlight, and they deserve to be, but the emphasis is on preparing students for college and careers. Without civic education and preparation for a democratic life, what difference will prosperity make? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Heyman.
Good morning, welcome. Chairman Dimbrough and committee members. I am Jan Christensen, and I chair the Civic Engagement Advocacy Committee, for City Club. Thank you so much for inviting us today, and we just had to bring all these outstanding students. I know that it took a few minutes to hear from them, but you can see why it's so exciting to work with them and have them with us, and we knew that you would appreciate that. Today we have shared a story with you, a story that began long ago when our country's founders recognized the need to educate citizens in the principles of democracy and established the public education system. And this has always been and will continue to be an important story for anyone who is focused on developing an effective workforce, because we know that good citizens are effective contributors to their communities. Our story stops here because we don't have an ending. You've heard several pieces of the story from many different perspectives, all of whom are here today because they recognize the importance of a comprehensive civics education. The good news is that our ending doesn't need huge amounts of money thrown at it, and it doesn't need people power that we don't already have in our classrooms and communities, but it does need a shift in thinking, and here's how you can help. This story needs legislative leadership to require the Department of Education to continue to comply with existing Oregon statutes, specifically Oregon statutes 329.025 and 336.067 that call for rigorous content standards in a variety of subjects, including civics, and directs public schools to give special emphasis to the Constitution, saying, quote, other and teaching other lessons that promote and develop the citizenry. We need continued leadership from the Department of Education to support a strong social studies and civics curriculum, including the professional development that teachers not only need but want. And we need anyone involved in shaping education policy from the OEIB to the school district level to add the words civic engagement to the often repeated mantra of college and career, so that it now becomes college, career, and civic engagement. We wanted to update you, too, on a City Club effort a little closer to home. This is in the Portland metropolitan area that we are hoping you will all be a part of next fall. On Friday, October 11th, City Club is about to announce a new partnership with the Multnomah Bar Association and their foundation in support of a civic award program that will recognize outstanding community efforts for youth civic engagement. The winners will be announced at the forum on October 11th, and we would like to have all of you there to be recognized for your efforts at the state level. We are also doing work with Portland State University, with Dr. Thiemann, and with our largest school district to facilitate a partnership for a possible audit of social studies. And we continue to advocate at meetings such as this. We sincerely thank you for your time today and for allowing all of us to speak, and for all of your efforts throughout our state on behalf of all of our citizens, particularly those who have not yet had the opportunity to find their voices. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jan. Rep. Gallegos, then Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough. I have a question about we talk in here a lot about giving people opportunity for education and as we've said, civic engagement being a large part of the democratic process and hopefully the goal to which we're educating our citizens. To what degree are we doing outreach to immigrant populations, non-English speaking populations, that kind of thing? I'm just curious what you might.
I think that
that is a critical piece of the mission of schools of education. And at Portland State University and at other universities, we are focusing on improving the skills of our future teaching force in working effectively with immigrant children and their families. So we're increasing the coursework in ESL strategies. But elementary teachers are where the story of civic engagement begins. And they're the ones that need the support to have time to engage their students in discussions such as Abigail Woods described, and also to enable immigrant children who come into the schools with little or no English to increase those skills as rapidly as possible so they also have a voice in those class discussions and in civic engagement activities.
Thank you. Thank you. Rip Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. I appreciate your words. Are either one of you aware of Edie Hirsch's work?
Yes.
Okay. Rep. Dembro and I were at an Education Commission of the States conference last July in Atlanta, I think. It was toasty. I mean,
December.
This wasn't New Orleans. This is Atlanta.
Oh, yeah.
But Edie Hirsch was there, received a Lifetime Achievement Award, but he is the founder of what's known as the Core Knowledge Foundation. He's written numerous books, but his contention is that as you talk about barriers to civic knowledge and stuff, that the problem we have is that in our public school system in America, our curriculum is devoid of core knowledge. At the point in time while we are teaching kids to learn, to read, to write, to become academically, used to going to school and so forth, instead of actually helping them, providing content that has meaning and substance, it's fairy dog tales and puppy dog, whatever, it's wizards and that kind of thing, instead of some academic content that they can be taking in at the same time. And just an example, I'm on his website right now, and for a kindergarten curriculum under the heading of history and geography, the emphasis here is you start talking on the world sense, you start talking about geography from a spatial sense, an overview of the seven continents, you get into the American history, we talk about geography, Native American peoples, past and present, you move up to early exploration and settlement, the voyage of Columbus, the pilgrims, July 4th, presidents past and present. All this can be woven into a kindergarten curriculum that students can, as they're learning to read, instead of reading about make-believe stuff, they're actually reading about real things, can begin to impart core knowledge that can begin to create an interest in civics and a basic knowledge so that as they confront things, this is kindergarten, and it builds from there. But his point, if you're wasting all our time in America by not putting core knowledge into our students, so I'd just like to get your feelings about that. As you talk about barriers to civics, and his point would be is, you know, a teacher doesn't need to take a break to teach social studies. It's enfolded into the curriculum that actually is in the classroom.
Well, I have a couple responses. I certainly am sympathetic to Dr. Hirsch's critique of social studies education, and we at NCSS have said that we lament the emphasis on food, flags, and festivals in elementary social studies curriculum when there is so much more important historical and civic and economic Correct. Knowledge and geographic knowledge that students need to learn in elementary school. My social studies student teachers at middle school now tell me, Gail, my students don't even know how to read a map. They had no social studies in elementary school. How can they possibly understand complex international issues when they don't even know where other countries of the world are? So I think we're in solid agreement with that. There are two challenges. One is the slide I showed you about the time for social studies. Less than 3 hours a week is an average. That means that in some schools, there is no social studies taught at all at the elementary level, especially when you have a lot of students who are coming with very few skills in reading and writing. That is incredibly important that students learn to read and write immediately and that they develop numeracy skills. But the social studies content can be woven into what they're learning to read. The Common Core standards are a step in the right direction because of the emphasis on informational text. And that's a big push now in Oregon schools in middle level and high school. But when you look at the Common Core standards for high school, it just says literacy. It doesn't say content.
And that's and so all we have supporting the teachers in Oregon are the Oregon Department of Education social studies standards that were developed and revised a few years ago and are very worthy. But teachers have to know themselves. And at elementary school, teachers are supposed to be an expert in everything, reading and writing and math and science. And when do they learn to be experts in civic education and history? That's why professional development resources, because a teacher will be have a career of 30 years. What they learned 30 years ago may not be what they need to be teaching today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Thiemann. Colleagues, if you just have a quick statement to make, because we have another subject to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to take time. Thank you for your presentations. Thank you for your leadership. We really needed you. We need you, Mrs. Woods, Ms. Woods, and other people like that. In 2005, 2007, Congress Lady Bonamici and myself introduced legislation to add back into the high school curriculum half a unit of civics and a half a unit of personal financial management. It was defeated because, and I don't see anyone from ODE here, because of supposedly cost. The State Board of Education finally did what you referenced, Doctor, put as essential skill level civics, and that's a good step. I don't think it's enough. I hope schools are adding it on their own, even though the state will not support it. I think one of the things I've been involved with, the We the People programs and the people that talked today about the competition is very good. You know, another thing you might think about, Chair, your commission, is we've had in the past schools or organizations propose legislation and see how it works to get through the system. I think that would be a good participation thing. Also then, I would ask, are you familiar with the Intercollegiate Study Institute and the American Civics Literacy Program? Which is, again, I passed out to the members of the committee, I introduced a bill in 2011 to ask the colleges to report back. It's reported by the institution that people enter college with more civics knowledge than they come out with. And that's a disgrace. So not only do our elementary, middle school, and high schools need to work on this, but it appears our colleges are failing us too. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
One more person. I think this goes to a larger issue outside of the state. If you look at just, I teach geography, so if you look at geography, a number of years ago, the kind of lead institutions, Ivy League schools, dumped geography. And I've seen in the state also that frequently teacher certifications or teacher education, they've removed geography as a requirement. And so I think there's probably work to be done at the federal level because I think it's systemic throughout our society, not just in the state.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much.
Let me just say in closing, colleagues, again, I want to congratulate the Grant High School team for a remarkable achievement, and actually really all of Oregon. You know, as I understand it, Oregon is in the top 10 every year in that program, which is unbelievable. If you know how that program works and how competitive it is, and you know the rigor that's required, you know we tend to focus on what's not working in Oregon education. This is something that really is clearly working, and I think part of why it's working is that there's a whole community of support behind these programs. The coaches, you know, volunteering their time. Parents, the kids fundraise. I mean, it's the total package. And so not only is it the content of what they're doing, not only is it, you know, the competition itself, but the community that's built around it. That I believe, is the future of educational progress. So thank you very much for giving this to us. And with that, I'll close this part of the agenda and open up the agenda to our patiently waiting presenters on dual credit. Colleagues, we wanted to get an update of what's going on in dual credit these days. To that end, we have a panel, Larry Shane, Karen, and Mike Seelig. Come on up.
It was great.
Yeah. going to give us the broad overview, and then we're going to get to the reality, thanks to Salem-Keizer School District.
Thank you, Chair Dumbrough and the committee. I'm Michael Selig. I'm the Strategic Initiatives Director for the Oregon Education Investment Board. And we've arranged this so that we're not over-speaking each other or covering things duplicatively. So I'm going to provide more or less of a high-level overview of how OEIB sees dual credit fitting into our larger work of reaching 40-40-20. And then Karen and Larry are going to dig down a little bit deeper into the details. So OEIB's goal, obviously, is 40-40-20 by 2025. This is something that we've been hearing a lot. Our mission in getting there is to build an education system that is ultimately responsive to the needs of students and families. And we want to do this now at a time when students are more diverse, coming from more diverse background, and have a greater range of needs than they ever have at any other time in Oregon, and certainly in the United States. Rebuilding a P20 pipeline involves doing a number of things, the least of which is identifying inefficiencies in the existing system and building them in anew, in accordance with the needs of a 21st century education system. One of the greatest inefficiencies we've identified here is in this transition between high school and post-secondary education. We've talked about 11 to 14 or 9 to 14 schools, these grades, because we feel that keeping kids on that track through that that transition period is essential to keeping them on track and reaching 40-40-20. Dual credit, we feel, is one of the best ways to address this issue, and by being strategic about how we approach it and the way that it can be enacted by high schools and community college, we feel that this is one place where we can really improve student outcomes. So there's four distinct areas of the P20 redesign where dual credit's going to be important. So the first is going to be helping students avoid the trappings of placement tests or inconsistent course descriptions and demands that vary by institution. We know right now that HB 2979 is addressing common course numbering. This is one piece of it. But helping students be on a pathway so that they don't just arrive at the community college and have to sort of face the registration and course catalog without a lot of context for how what they've done is connecting to where they will go. We feel this is going to be an important step in helping kids stay on the path. The second area is around CTE and STEM. These articulated programs that we see through places like Sabin Schellenberg Center, we've seen the ACE Academy and the Clackamas Academy of Industrial Sciences. They're currently articulating CTE and STEM programs from high school through college so that students now have a meaningful context for their learning. So it's not just about taking a class that they'll get credit for, but about taking a class that has a context that they can see a job, a future, a career, oftentimes they're getting internships and other opportunities to see along the way, so that by the time they arrive in that school, in college, they already have an understanding for the path that they're on and understand the purpose and meaning of their education. It doesn't seem like it's just spinning their wheels. The third place here is students with college credit we know feel more empowered to continue their education and are more likely to complete an AA or BA. This is really important, especially with first-generation students who may not have the confidence to go to college or have been continuously told that that's not for them. When you leave high school and suddenly you've got 9 or 12 college credits already in your pocket, that's a very empowering thing for a student. And it almost sort of tricks them into saying, well, I might as well just go on and continue. I'm already halfway there. So the fourth area we feel this is important is in reducing the cost of college by eliminating a lot of these credits at the college level that could now be taken at the high school level. We know two-year institutions have largely become 3- and 4-year institutions, and 4-year institutions have oftentimes become 5- and 6-year institutions. And while we can't directly address the cost of tuition, one thing we can do is reduce the amount of time that a student needs to spend at those places and help them get some of those credits taken care of before they ever walk through the doors of a U of O or an OSU. So those are the four big areas I think that dual credit's really going to affect the goal of 40-40-20 and OEIB's mission of building a P20 pipeline that's responsive to the needs of all of our students and families.
Thank you. you. Thanks for that overview, Mike. And colleagues, I might just point out that House Bill 2979, the Common Course Number bill, passed the Senate yesterday, so it's headed to the governor.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Karen Marinjal. I'm the Interim Vice Chancellor for Academic Standards Strategies at the Oregon University System. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you today. Michael provided a great overview pointing to some of the national research, which we also draw on quite heavily in influencing the work that we do around dual credit and other early accelerated options for students. And so I want to just first frame with you the larger context in which dual credit sits, because it's important to understand all of the opportunities that are available to students, and Michael alluded to some of those. There are various types of accelerated learning opportunities available to students at the high school level, and these include dual credit programs, which could occur at the student's high school or on a college campus, but also things that you've heard of, advanced placement and international baccalaureate. And I have some handouts for you that talk about some of the facts and figures and statistics related to advanced placement and dual credit. And I just want to say the reason why international baccalaureate is not included in those handouts is because those data are harder to get our hands on. So we don't have data as readily available to us for applied baccalaureate students in the way that we do some others. As Michael said, national and our own state data show that when students participate in accelerated credit opportunities, they're not only more likely to enroll in college, but to persist and complete college. And so the data from Oregon bear that out, as do the data nationally. So we are very much in favor of encouraging high school students, when they're prepared, to take advanced learning opportunities while they're in high school. The institutions in OUS have been providing college course opportunities to high school students, both at a cost savings and to give students a leg up, for over 35 years. So we have a long history of doing this. All seven OUS institutions provide a variety of programs in coordination with Oregon high schools throughout the state. And as I said, some of these take place in the high school, so students attend their normal high schools and they're taught college courses where they can get college credit from their high school teachers who are certified by the Oregon institutions, universities. Or students can opt to go to a college class, a community college, or an OUS college, and actually take a course there. And so our faculty are really engaged in this. Our faculty are also national leaders in the advanced placement program. They work collaboratively with high school teachers. They review and score tests. They review curriculum. So they're quite involved in these opportunities. And the campuses, and Larry's part of this committee that we work on together, the campuses work together to set policy for awarding credits for advanced placement and international baccalaureate for all students. So when students are looking to apply the credits that they've earned in high school, they don't have to try to shop around to different universities or different community colleges. Everyone's on the same page. And it's actually a very nice group to work with, because we have a consistent policy throughout the state. We're pointing to nationally for that policy and for the work that we do. And we also take on research questions from time to time, so investigating how well the policies are serving students. So we have some research feeding back into the policymaking process.
Excuse me, Karen.
Yes, sir. We had the briefing from Eastern Promise. Now, you're saying that all the university, if they're approved, but Eastern Oregon has a special agreement with their people. That's not in this system. Is that correct?
So, Chair Dembro, Representative Weissnett, that's a very good question. The policy that I'm referring to is specifically for advanced placement and international baccalaureate courses. And so if a student, say, receives a score of five on an advanced placement calculus exam, they're getting the same credit for that exam no matter the universities. Eastern Promise, they're advocating for advanced placement where it can be, but also dual credit, and so they'll receive college credit for those.
A quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. So, the example they gave, which I thought was great, is they have a ninth grade class that they call Success,
and that was accepted as a college course by Easter, but that's not going to be accepted state or university system, I'm assuming.
So Chair Dembrough, Representative Wisnett, that's correct. So yeah, so that is
the relationship in that system.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to turn to a couple of, I have five handouts for you, and I want to turn to some of the information on those handouts just to go into a deeper dive into some of this. The first few sheets on your handout are related to advanced placement, and so this gives some figures about the our participation growth. And so you can see that since 2001, the number of students who are participating in advanced placement, so these are students who are graduating high school with scores of 3 or more on an AP exam, and those are typically the scores that award college credit, have grown considerably. And the number of graduates leaving high school just having taken any high school, any AP exam, whether or not they get a score of 3 or more, has also risen. And I use AP because I think it's a good bellwether for some of the trends in the state. On the next sheet, these are just some statistics about students bringing in advanced placement credit to Oregon universities. And so these are 2011-2012 figures, you can see that newly admitted freshmen brought in over 2,500 AP credits, and that equated out to a savings of over close to $6 million for these students. On the next slide, which is the color map, I come back to this slide quite often because I think it's a good indication of our access problem in this state. And so where you see green is good, and we'd like to see all of Oregon being green. But the places where you have reds or oranges are places with very low participation in advanced placement. Now, this could be for a variety of reasons. And again, I'm just using the advanced placement data as a bellwether for other trends in the state. But as you can see, we have large swaths of the state where students are not participating in advanced placement. Again, not to say that advanced placement is the end-all be-all, but we should be asking hard questions about what's the access for these students. If these students don't have access to advanced placement, do they have access to other dual credit opportunities? You'll notice on the map, unsurprisingly, that these portions of the state are places where they're not close to universities or colleges. So we know that distance is a factor. So we have a lot of unanswered questions, but I think this map gives you a nice overview. Turning more specifically to dual credit, I also have data from 2011-2012 talking about how many high school students were served, and this is just by Oregon University System dual credit programs. With the community colleges, this bumps these numbers up quite significantly. But we have over 3,500 high school students being served by dual credit programs at the Oregon University System. That's an increase of 12.5% over the previous year. So again, the trending is continuing upward. And again, the total savings in Oregon for these students was over $5 million. So this is saving students money. This is real. This is real money for the students, real money for the state. And then the last slide in your handout talks a little bit about the research that Michael alluded to, but it's Oregon specific. So there are clear benefits for students who participate in Oregon dual credit programs. Of course, we haven't controlled for students, so these are the students who choose to participate. We don't have a control group, but you can look at how the statistics bear out. Graduates, high school graduates who are more likely to enroll in college, they're more likely to continue onto a second year of college with a higher average GPA, and they accumulate more college credits at the start of their second fall term. These are all for students who took dual credit. Our office has done and continues to do extensive study of students who enroll in dual credit in high school and their further success in college, and so we're in the midst of finishing up another report that we'll take another look at these data.
Karen, can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Have you controlled or have you analyzed the data looking at SES or racial minority kind of?
Chair Dembrough, great question. Yes, we have, and we found that irrespective of racial identity, of socioeconomic status, that these facts bear out for those students.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
Vice Chancellor. This is great facts. You should use this as part of our sales pitch to the public and to the Could you have any, collected data showing that people graduate with an undergraduate degree in 3 years or 3.5 years? Because that's another big savings if you put in that too.
Chair Dembro, Representative Worthnet, that's a great point. I can look for those data. I don't know that we haven't, off the top of my head, we haven't seen that it actually saves students a half a year. What this allows students is the opportunity to double major, to take classes, take more of a variety of classes and still graduate within 4 years. But I can certainly look up that data and get that back to you.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Because, a lot of parents call us and saying kids is the living expenses, too. So if you can get them out in 3 years or 3.5, we're talking about return on investment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I just want to close by mentioning Eastern Promise and some of the other. So you've heard about Eastern Promise, so you know about the basic structure of that, of what they're doing. Eastern Promise is a really nice example of how the university is working with local high schools, the Education Service District, and the local community colleges to come to some shared understanding of student learning outcomes. So they're working with professional learning communities involving faculty from the colleges and universities, teachers from the high schools, and saying, when a student completes, writing 121, these are the outcomes that they should have, and if students can demonstrate that at the high school, they should be receiving college credit for it. And so they're doing it in a structure that allows for advanced placement is expensive, dual credit is often, often not possible for a variety of reasons. So they're doing it in a way that's outcomes-based, proficiency-based, we're studying that to make sure that that's working. I should also mention that in the southern part of the state, Southern Oregon University with Rogue Community College and its Education Service District are working on something similar called the Southern Success. Mm. And we also have a history of our other universities, Portland State in particular, who have done extensive outreach and professional development to dual credit high school teachers. So we do, at the universities, we do take very seriously working in close collaboration with high schools, and I'll close there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Karen. Larry.
Hi. Good morning.
Welcome.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee. I'm Larry Shane with the Oregon Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And I do have to just mention that I was so glad to hear you talk about career and technical education for the last public comment portion, because as you know, those student leadership organizations connect with those, have a really strong civic engagement piece. That was fantastic. I'll just stack a little bit of data onto what Karen mentioned. If you factor in the students that are doing the dual credit courses through community colleges, it's about another 25,000 or so per year. It's pretty significant in our state. I did want to just briefly mention some models that we're seeing emerge and grow in Oregon. Now, we've had early college or middle college types of programs in our state. Portland Community College has a very strong one. Chemeketa has one and a few others. But we're seeing that emerge as well. And a couple examples are Lane Community College will be bringing about another 160 to 180 high school students to the campus through their Regional Technology Education Center starting next fall. And that early college model where you bring a student onto the campus and they finish their high school and start their college work simultaneously is really powerful. It takes advantage of a principle called power of sight, which, as you can imagine, when you bring students to a campus, and oftentimes these programs are for students that may not be likely headed to college, it just infuses them with not only confidence but also a challenge to excel. We're also seeing a model at Klamath Community College called the Advanced Diploma, where they've forged an agreement with both the Klamath County School District and the Klamath Falls City School District, and there'll be students coming to KCC. I think they have about 140 students already interested in starting next fall, where they'll be completing an advanced diploma, high school diploma, and starting their college experience kind of in that fifth year model. So it's a couple of other very good examples of acceleration that I think we will see continued interest in and growth over the next few years.
Thank you, Larry. Representative.
Yeah. follow up on that comment, you know, the graduation rates for Redmond just came out in high school, and it was like in below 50, but because they've got the five-year program, that they're so their mm-hmm. children are staying, so they're coming up to, eight, you know, after 5 years, it's over 80% mm-hmm. because they're taking advantage of that. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the economy, guys.
Mm-hmm. Larry, could you say something more about 2+2, you know, traditional 2+2 sort of CTE mm-hmm. partnerships, high school to mm-hmm. college?
Yes, Chair Dembro and members of the committee, we have what's called the Career and Technical Education Program of Study model in Oregon, and it was really driven largely by the federal Perkins funds, that legislation. But, you know, the bottom line is it's a good idea. It's really connecting your high school career and technical education program with your college career and technical education program in a seamless or non-duplicative sequence of courses. And it's really based on student learning outcomes and standards. And kind of the jewel of the realm for those programs is when there is an opportunity to articulate that credit, whether it's business or welding or culinary arts. And we see quite a bit of that. In terms of numbers, and this is somewhat concerning, we have seen overall dual credit continue to, you know, stick around the 25,000 students or so participating. It'll fluctuate and go up and down a little bit. But we're seeing a growth in lower division collegiate and somewhat of a drop-off in CTE. And I think, you know, there may be a number of factors related to that. Some of it has to do with, you know, high school CTE programs having been cut, quite frankly. But anyway, it's still a strong program. It's still really valuable for students, and it's something I see Oregon continuing to do.
Thank you very much. Okay, thanks all three of you. We're running a little short on time, but I do want to hear from our friends from Salem-Keizer. So Salam and Charlene, would you come up, please? Pleasure for me to have Salam testify into this committee. Salam used to be one of the shining stars in the Department of Education, and now I assume a shining star for Salem-Keizer.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Salam Noor, Assistant Superintendent for Salem-Keizer Public Schools, and with me is Charlene Grove, our Coordinator of Career and Technical Education Programs and Dual Credit Programs as well. We truly appreciate your interest in this topic and the opportunity to share some information with you today. When you sit in these hearings and listen to students and community advocates and distinguished panels like this, you don't want to be redundant, so I had to modify some comments a little bit, and we'll try to keep them focused and brief because I know you're pressed on time. But when we think of dual credit, we think it's really, really essential to provide that opportunity for all students in our district. And if I may tell you a little bit about our district, we serve over 40,000 students. We're the second largest district in the state of Oregon. We have 65 schools. That includes charters and alternative programs. 15% of our students are English language learners. 25% of our students hear a language other than English at home, so we have a high level of diversity in our district, in our community, that we're extremely proud of. 65% of our students are eligible for free and reduced lunch program, so we do have a high level of poverty. So college becomes an integral part of workforce development, and that is a concern that your community has. So when we think about dual credit, we recognize that most career pathways require some level of college preparation, whether it's in an academic area that leads to an associate degree or in a career technical education area that leads into workforce preparation. So in order for our students to be really competitive, we want to provide them this opportunity in every possible way we can. And when we think of dual credit, we think of academic articulation, for example, English language arts, science, math. We also have CTE credits that are articulated in many programs. Nursing and health are examples of that. We also think of AP and the IB program, and you heard a little bit about early college. We have an early college high school on the Chemeketa Community College campus that serves nearly 400 students. Many of them opt to stay for that fifth year. Many of them essentially become Chemeketa Community College students in that fifth year, and we jointly provide services to them. Many of them come close to graduating with an associate degree, so they actually have a high school diploma and an associate degree, and many average anywhere from 50 to 70 credits by the time they are finished with their high school education. And that is an innovative program that we're very proud of. We're fortunate to have lots of partnerships with many community colleges and universities. We have our partnership with Chemeketa Community College, Western Oregon University, Oregon Institute of Technology, Rogue Community College, Lynn Benton Community College, Portland Community College, and Mount Hood Community College, where we have some articulated programs that afford our students opportunities to get college credit while they're in high school. Let me just briefly talk about the benefits of dual credit. It's something that we get excited about. It's something that we know students get excited about, teachers are extremely enthusiastic about, and parents as well. So for teachers, it really provides an opportunity for teachers and college faculty to work together relative to content, relative to the materials that they're teaching and delivering in their classrooms. And this collaboration actually helps inform the college faculty of the type of preparation that students have as they come into their system, but most importantly, it helps inform the high school teacher of the skills and knowledge and requirements that students have to have in order to be successful in a college environment. The alignment of curriculum and programs improves the content and the instruction that we provide to students, and most importantly, we really use that as an opportunity to raise the rigor and the expectations. And students get more engaged because they know they're potentially are going to college and this class is going to count for college credit. So speaking of students, these opportunities provide a really smooth transition between high school and college, and I think Michael alluded to these. It gives students a jump start on their college education. And it has a tremendous cost saving, and Charlene will give you some numbers relative to that. For our high-achieving students, sometimes by the time they're a junior or a senior in high school, they've exhausted everything that the school has to offer them. So having dual credit options and opportunities really opens, continues that education and that academic development on their part, and really opens opportunities for them to explore different courses and subject matter that's available to them. For us, and the reason I wanted to tell you the percentage of poverty that we have in our district and the fact that a high percentage of our students are English language learners, they are an integral part of our workforce, not just in Salem, but in Oregon and nationally. For many of them, the opportunity to enroll in an AP course that potentially leads to college credit after they take the AP exam, to enroll in the IB program, to enroll in a CTE course that's articulated with a community college or a university for that matter, to enroll in any kind of high school course that leads to college credit is really a gateway, if you will, to a college education, because that gives the student the confidence and the belief in themselves that they can actually go to college and do well in college, whereas that option would have never been considered by them or their families. So if I were to speak about parents, as a parent having had students taking advantage of this option, it's a wonderful cost savings to pay $25 for transcripting a 3-credit class instead of paying $700 or $500, whatever the cost may be, depending on the institution that you're going to. So there is a tremendous cost savings for parents, but also for those parents of students that have not had the benefit of going to college in the past, the parents have not had the option of attending college in the past. It's a wonderful opportunity to open those doors for their kids and to give them that inspiration, if you will. So I very quickly wanted to go through those three areas: teachers, students, and parents. There are some challenges, however, as we continue to do this work and our desire to expand it and grow it. So the challenges is one of access, and quite often is not necessarily barriers that are keeping us from getting that access. It's really capacity of the partner post-secondary institution. For example, Chemeketa is very interested in enrolling our students in career and technical education programs, but they don't have the capacity, they don't have the space. Because of the economy, their enrollment has skyrocketed, which limits the space that are available for high school students. Some of these articulation agreements are person-dependent, so if there is a relationship between the teacher and the faculty member that facilitates a great deal of ease and interaction, if that relationship is not there, then there may be some barriers and some challenges. Some of these articulation agreements are governed regionally, so our first partner is Chemeketa, and we have to work through Chemeketa to get to these other institutions. Consistency in the process, it varies. The teacher certification or approval process varies dramatically from one institution to another. And the minimum requirements are not always clear in terms of, should it be in a baccalaureate degree with lots of experience in that discipline? Does it always have to be a master's degree? So I think some consistency along these lines would help make the process more predictable. The challenge relative to resources is really one of providing the funding, if you will, for teachers and faculty to come together, to work together on alignment, articulation, shared planned course statements, et cetera. So I talked really fast. My apologies. I'm going to have, if you don't mind, Charlene, a couple of minutes to talk about some of our data.
Thank you, Salam. And I will say we did pass legislation to promote those kinds of interactions.
Excellent.
However, we have not yet found funding for it.
Okay. Thank you.
A familiar story. Yes, Charlene, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough, committee members. Thank you so much for having us here and listening to our story about dual credit in our district. We are excited about the opportunities we're able to offer. As you heard from Larry, career technical education is based on strong alignments with community college programs, and we have a long history in career tech ed of dual alignment articulations. In Salem-Keizer, 80% of our CTE teachers are able to offer dual credit, so we're really pleased about that. Across our district, we have some isolated cases in our academic areas where we're able to offer credit, particularly in math and language arts. But based on these great partnerships that we've had with community colleges, 1,600 students were able to capitalize on 4,800 credits that saved their families $330,000 last year. We're really pleased with these opportunities, and as Salam mentioned, particularly with our student population, it's a wonderful jump start for kids. As pleased as we are with those numbers, that represents only 15% of our students. It represents only 1% of our instructors that are approved. So we really believe that we have capacity to do more. Access, as Salam mentioned, is really part of our challenge right now in the partners that we're working with and some of the teacher licensure approval issues that are really preventing us from being able to expand this opportunity to more students. As we're looking at college and career readiness, we really think this is the pathway for students to really get them started and jump started on a career and college and workforce ready. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Rinlin. Any questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
quick.
Rip Thompson.
Salam, it's in your district. Have you had any issues or problems, let's say, with ADMW, and when a student is primarily engaged in K-12 work and then also is doing maybe the majority of their academic stuff in the higher ed realm? Do you have any problems with waiting and funding formula issues? Because I know that's one of those things that still needs to be worked out to really make this a seamless transition.
Yeah. Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, that is something that we're aware that can become a barrier, if you will. In our case, we've actually focused our conversations relative to the opportunity and not necessarily the funding. So we often talk about getting our teachers ready and approved to offer dual credit, and then we work out the financial arrangements. With Chemeketa, for example, we have a partnership, we have a contract that's been in place for the last 7 years, and there is an actual amount that we provide for every student that enrolls at Chemeketa. So we have it arranged where initially it's a portion of the ADM. Okay. When the student enters cohort 3, which essentially they are a Chemeketa Community College student, then our responsibility is the tuition for that student, which is less than what you would typically pay in the first or second cohort, if you will. So we tried to focus our conversations on the opportunity to articulate programs, to align programs, and then talk about the funding. We've been fortunate that it has not been an issue. At Chemeketa, the challenge for us is we have a greater demand than we're able to meet. However, the funding then, it's just we have to cap it at a certain level because it becomes cost prohibitive after that.
Okay.
But we have not had any conflict with institutions relative to the ADM or the FTE that community colleges generate as a result of that. We just try to work it out to the best that we can.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, both of you, for coming.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Then I'm going to close the informational hearing. Colleagues, thank you very much for your patience. This was a very, very, very informative day, I think. And thanks to all who came to be part of it. Just want to remind you that we are not meeting on Friday. On Monday, we are going to be hearing and probably working three bills that should be fairly simple. So we're not going to start till 9 o'clock on Monday. 9 o'clock on Monday.
All right. You can work in quick.
So with that, I'll see you 9 o'clock on Monday.
Excellent.
We're adjourned. Thanks.